All right, folks, it is a pleasure for me to introduce Katie Teft. Katie Teft is a program attorney at TMCEC. I think many of y'all know Katie. She supervises and oversees our Bailiff and Warrant Officers program. She was the person who head up our super popular Green Book. Y'all know what I'm talking about, that list of all those Class C misdemeanors. So she did that this last time. Katie got her undergraduate degree from Southwestern, got her law degree from Mercer in Georgia. Prior to coming to work for the center, she worked at the Attorney General's office. She's here to talk to you about a subject that y'all, I'm sure, will be interested in, or you wouldn't have come to this topic, and also one that's always good to be able to explain to city bureaucrats, where does the money go? So put your hands together and welcome the very sunburned Katie Teft. Thank you.
My nose is peeling today, so I guess I let it go that I had a garage sale this weekend, but I made $334, and I can tell you where that money is going because that's why I did it. All right, so I just wanted to dispel any notions before we get started that we're not going to bore you today with a class just on court costs. So anybody who's here just because they want to learn more about court costs, I taught this to the judges last year, clerks, you guys have had all the experience in court costs, but we're going to go ahead and wake everybody up right after lunch and just show a cute little video clip. How many of you feel like that when you're having to do your monthly report or when you're having to collect money and send it on to the comptroller? All right, so like I said, today's not a class just focusing solely on court costs. But what we're going to talk about today is this concept of where does the money go? And I'll tell you a little backstory about why this class got put together. This is something that, how many of you call the 800 line? Okay. So we're starting to see this trend of calls, especially in this economy. Everybody's looking at budgets and checkbooks and check registers and everything else and wanting to figure out, you know, where's our money going? Why do we not have more? Why can't we afford to do more? And so we were seeing this trend of court clerks and judges calling the 800 line saying, I have to go before counsel and testify about why we're not collecting more money. Or, you know, counsel wants to know why so much of our money that we're collecting is going on to the state. And so I thought, maybe it's time we put together a class that just looks at a comprehensive listing of all of the costs and all of the fines and all of the fees that our courts are going to collect that are going to have to be sent on to the state. So really, the benefit of coming to this session is the handout that you have. And we're going to go through it, and I'm going to show you what it is, but there's a chart, there's a little paper associated with it. So that's going to be the takeaway here. Everybody wants a little souvenir, or I call them a pookie. Ryan gets mad at me when I say that, says that's a pet name. He calls them a souvenir, whatever it is. The takeaway here is this little handout. But we're going to do a couple activities today to try to put all this into perspective, to figure out what it is we're talking about, to look at what it is we do as courts, and then also to try to come up with some responses to the question, where does the money go? Whether you're getting that from your city councils, your mayors, your bosses, yourself. We taught this class to law enforcement one time because they're also getting it. You know, you're just out there trying to collect money for the city because you're writing me tickets every day. So we're trying to do this topic to everybody just to kind of give us a way to respond to some of these claims. But it's after lunch. I want to wake everybody up, get everybody involved. So I'm going to ask everybody to stand up. Take you out of your comfort zone for a second. And I'm going to read you a quote that was printed in a prominent Central Texas newspaper. These are true words that somebody else has said. At the end, I'll tell you who it is who said it. But I want you to sit down at the point when you get offended, okay? All right. You ready? Don't sit down right away. I figure it's better, you know, everybody wants to sit down. I didn't want you to have to stand up because then nobody would participate. So, okay, these are real words. I think it's great that we are allowing lesser payment for early payment, and it's probably nice that we are becoming more user-friendly on court day. However, there's no way I'm going to return to a couple of years ago when the municipal court was a big hole in our budget. I don't like the idea of a blank check. Why are we having court if it's just creating budgetary problems? My requirement is an efficient, sit down when you get offended, cost-effective, hopefully budgetary-neutral court. I've got to ask myself somewhere along the line if I want to continue in this business. If the court does slip back into costing the city money, we have an alibi to dissolve the court. So the court needs to keep that in mind. Not offended? No? Okay. Well, good. I want to hear from you. I was trying to prove the point. I figured less people would stand up if I had you stand up when you got offended. But this was something that kind of, we read this and we got concerned because we don't want the court to be viewed as an expendable liability in any city. The court is there because we are a court. And so we're going to do a little activity and think about this notion of the court and what it means. And I have some pictures passed around throughout the room. And kind of get in small groups. Look with the person next to you. Some of you might have two pictures sitting. There should be little laminated photos. And I just want you to take a look at these pictures and talk about what words these pictures evoke. What, if you're sitting by yourself, get with the people behind you. You have two to look at. But talk about the adjectives that come to mind, the feelings that come to mind when you look at these pictures. See if you can figure out what they are. And then we'll take a minute to just kind of work in small groups, and then we'll share them all with the group. Okay. So I'm going to put these pictures up on the big screen. We're a small group. Doesn't take that long to do this. But I'm going to put them up here. And then if you had this picture, if you were looking at it, just kind of share some of the thoughts that came to mind, some of the adjectives that describe the picture, some of the feelings that might be evoked when you look at this kind of picture. So who started with this one? All right. What are some of the things that came to mind when you looked at this picture? First of all, what is this? Supreme Court of the United States in Washington, D.C. So, anybody want to volunteer some thoughts? Expensive? What? Sterile? What else? Established? Any others, even if you didn't have this picture? Precedent? What about this next one? The inner chambers of the Supreme Court?
Regal.
Justice? Intimidating? How about commands respect? Authority. Foundation. Okay, I think that's a pretty good list. Now, what about this one? Who had this picture? Okay, what do y'all think this is? Neglected. That's a good one. I haven't heard that one before. Dumpy? What does it look like? Post office. I thought it looked like a feed store. Or like a, American Legion office. Okay, any others on this one? What about this one? The DMV? What does the DMV do? They usually process, collect. Collect money, impersonal, cold. Okay. And what about this one? Are you from Houston, Judge? Are you? Okay. That is court number 3 at the Houston Municipal Court. Yeah, people are there in court waiting. Looks like there might be a trial docket or some sort of docket. Somebody at the last school said, it looks like a very lopsided wedding. Everybody's seated on just one side. But let's say defendants, witnesses. Okay, so we know this one is a courtroom. It looks like it's a docket setting. Anything else?
Efficient.
Efficient. Okay, well, we can tell this is a courtroom. This is the Houston Municipal Court. Also a municipal court in Texas. This, also a municipal court in Texas. So the purpose of this is to look at these pictures and think, why is it when we look at these pictures that we know are the High Court of the United States, we think of things like justice. But when we look at the pictures of our own municipal courts in Texas, we think of things like collect money. We're all courts, right? Isn't all of our aims to do justice, to seek justice, to find justice? And so that leads us to this image that municipal courts in Texas are viewed as a cash cow. And the purpose of this class is to really look at what money it is that the court's bringing in, what that money is used for, and then also to talk about claims is to, you know, to kind of refute the idea that municipal courts in Texas should be viewed as a cash cow. Now, how many of my clerks are in here? You know why you're called clerks? Because it rhymes with work. And it's work to collect all these costs and figure out what to do with them. Okay, sorry, that was somebody else's joke I stole. All right, so a couple more real words, and let's see if we can guess who it is that says these. This was printed on a website in Texas. It says, practicality over principle here makes more sense. Traffic tickets are a cash cow for counties and municipalities like the small size we're in, which are small and need funds. It's not about fairness here. It's about revenue for them. Who do you think said this? All the defendants say that? Wasn't a defendant. Close, but not quite. City manager, no. This one's actually a defense attorney, which I know judges, a lot of our judges are defense attorneys. Defense attorneys make money off traffic tickets too, but this was printed on a defense attorney's website. What about this one? Municipal court fees and fines should be a moneymaker for the city. City council, city official. Close, this was actually the city prosecutor. So kind of surprising that it's not the defendants that say this. All right, so we're going to, it is surprising. Okay, so we're going to do another little activity, and I told you this isn't a court cost class. We're not going to bore you with numbers and math. I went to law school because I'm not a huge fan of math, and I will admit that when we did this in Tyler, I went home and double-checked my math, and it was completely wrong. That's what I get for typing it up at 3 in the morning, but I promise the math on there is correct, and if it's not, please let me know before I put it on our website and embarrass myself further. But we're going to look at this concept of what money it is that the court's bringing in and then where it's going to go by doing a hypothetical little sample citation here. So this is a citation written by a state trooper, a DPS trooper, Trooper Gotcha, to Ima Be In Trouble. And she was cited for passing a school bus, no insurance or FMFR, and having an unrestrained child aged 8 to 16. So it's not in a seatbelt. And so if we look at the citation, not unlike any of the citations that are going to come into any of your courts, if you flip to the back side of that first page, you'll see I've done a breakdown. And we're going to assume that the judge is imposing the minimum fine on each of these charges and also what court costs would be collected. Now, these are going to be the main base state court costs. This isn't going to include any of your local court costs. So if your court collects a security fund or technology fund, juvenile case manager fund, this isn't going to be including any of those. But these are going to be the base state court costs that we're going to collect. So you see the fine amounts here and what the fine imposed is. And we are going to assume that for purposes of this hypothetical, that Ms. Trouble comes in and she pleads guilty or no contest to all of these charges. Judge imposes the minimum fine, assesses the court costs, and puts her on a payment plan. And she has 6 months to pay this off, and she does. And we can kind of giggle because how often does that happen where somebody comes in, shows up on time, pleads guilty, takes their fine, and pays everything on time? We know that this is hypothetical law land. But so let's look at what cost it is that we're going to collect here. Now, I've put the big ones up here, and these are our main bulk state court costs that we know apply to all, you know, all offenses other than parking and pedestrian. We have our $40 consolidated fee, our judicial support fee, our indigent defense fee, our juror reimbursement fee, and you can see which portion is going to stay with the city and what portion of that fee is going to go to the state. We have the $30 state traffic fee is going to apply to most of these offenses, to the unrestrained child and to the passing a school bus because they are rules of the road offenses. And we see that $28.50 goes to the state and $1.50 will stay with the city. We have our pesky 10-cent moving violation fee that, you know, one red penny gets to stay with your city. Then we have our local traffic fee, our child safety fund, the arrest fee, which because this is written by a DPS trooper, he's a state officer, so we have to send a portion of that on to the state. And then because she was put on a six-month payment plan, we'd have to assess the time payment fee as well. Now, again, if she didn't appear, if she didn't pay, and we had to issue a capious pro fine, we'd deal with warrant fees and everything else. But we're assuming that everything was done timely, and these are the costs that would apply. And again, I'm not going to bore you with all the math and the numbers, but end result, assuming that she paid off everything that was in those judgments, the city would collect $812.20. The city would only end up keeping $524.12 of that money. Now, if you divide this out, that's about 65% that the city gets to keep. Now, I don't know how long it's been since everybody's been in school, but when I was in school, 65 was a failing grade. So we're looking at this, putting it into context that, you know, 35%, over a third of the money that we collect is going on to the state here. But let's even put this into a little deeper context and look at the second hypothetical citation. Here, instead, Ms. Trouble is cited for one charge, and that is having an unrestrained child who's 5 years old. Now, we know the law changed back in 2009. You have to be in a booster seat or a car seat or some sort of child safety seat if you're under eight. But we have a five-year-old who's not in a car, and so this, or not in a car seat, and so this is the only charge that Ms. Trouble is appearing in the court for. We see that the legislature gave us a maximum fine of $25. Again, we have a state officer who wrote it, so we have all of the same court costs that we've already discussed, the portion that's going to stay with the city and the portion that's going to go to the state. We have our court costs. We have to add that 15-cent child safety seat cost that we'll talk more about in a minute. And in the end result, the city's going to end up collecting $115.25 in court costs alone. This is going to be on a case that has a maximum fine of $25. We have to send half of that fine to the state. We have to send our portion of court costs to the state. We're going to end up sending the state $101.54 and keeping only $38.71. So here, we're keeping a third of what we send on to the state, or the state is getting two-thirds of the money that we collect. And what has the state done to earn any of this money that we're sending on? Nothing. So let's follow the money and figure out what it is that we're collecting and what's going to get sent. So what exactly do we send to the state? Now, the general belief here is that fines stay with your city. Fines benefit your city and court costs benefit the state. But we're going to find that there are exceptions to each of those. There are some court costs that are truly going to benefit your city, and there are some fines that the state wants their portion of that as well. And so we're going to break them down into sections, and we're going to start with the court costs or fees. The consolidated fee we put on here, this is the biggie. This is the one. It's going to apply to everything that's not a parking or pedestrian offense. It's going to apply on city ordinances. It's going to apply on state law offenses, everything that's not a parking or a pedestrian. Now, we're going to only discuss a few of the biggies on this chart, but this chart, like I said, is a pretty comprehensive listing of all court costs. There's statutes, so you can go and pull it up. If there are certain things that it needs to be used for, then you'll see little footnotes on the chart. So hopefully that chart will be a pretty helpful tool to refer back to. Now, your cities have to remit the portion of court costs and fines that have to go to the state timely. And we know this money gets remitted to the comptroller. And at the back of your handouts for this class, I've given you all of the forms for remitting court costs and fines and fees to the state. So you've got the quarterly report, all of the special ones that have different reports are in the back there. If your city remits this stuff timely, these reports timely, you can do it online, you can do it electronically, you can do it paper if you're still in the court where you're keeping everything tallied by pen and paper. But if the city remits timely to the comptroller, which is going to be at the end of each quarter, then your city can keep 10%. That's the general rule. And for the consolidated fund, your city would get to keep 10%. Now, the comptroller looks at this as kind of being a reward. So if you do what we want you to do timely and accurately, we're going to reward you by letting you keep 10%. Cities have budgeted to keep this money, and so if you don't remit timely, it's more of a penalty to your city if the money is not remitted timely. But that means your city is going to keep $4 of every case. This is going to apply to all convictions, to all deferreds, to all DSCs. Every case that doesn't result in a dismissal is going to end up, or in an acquittal or some sort of compliance dismissal, but any deferreds, any DSCs, any convictions are going to get this $40 consolidated fee. The consolidated fee went into effect back in 2003, and anybody who was around before then, you remember, it was a huge headache. You had to calculate out percentages and send 0.017% of every money collected to the trauma center fund and 0.00825 to T-Close to do whatever they do with it. Well, the legislature realized that this was becoming a headache, and so they decided to pass this one consolidated fund, and they said, no more court costs. From now on, everything's going to come out of the consolidated fund. You send it to us, and we'll divvy it up and send it to whoever. Well, that lasted until the next session, when the legislature passed the judicial support fee. This was a $6 fee that, again, applies to all parking and all offenses other than parking and pedestrian. Again, if your city remits it timely and accurately, you get to keep 10%, which is 60 cents. The interesting thing about the judicial support fee is that that 60 cents that your city keeps is going to go into your city's general revenue fund. You don't have to have a separate fund established for this, but that money is earmarked for a certain purpose. And the statute says that 60 cents that's retained by your city must be used to promote the efficient operation of the court and the investigation, prosecution, and enforcement of offenses that are within your court's jurisdiction. This is a great fund to use for training purposes. You know, everybody's training budgets and travel budgets are getting cut. But this judicial support fee, 60 cents of every case that results in conviction, deferred, or DSC, teen court, chemically dependent person, any of those deferral options, 60 cents of every one of those cases is supposed to be used to benefit the efficiency of your court. So just an interesting note there about the judicial support fee. Now let's skip down to the state traffic fine, because this is the other biggie. This is a $30 fee, and the legislature, we're in Texas. Everything in Texas is a Coke. I still say soda because I'm from Wisconsin, but everything in Texas is a Coke. We've got 18 definitions of complaint in the Code of Criminal Procedure. Everything is a warrant, even though it's really not a warrant. So we're used to calling everything by one name. And so the legislature here has done that again, where they've called this a fine. It's not a fine, it's a fee. But it's a $30 fee that applies to all rules of the road offenses. So anything that's in chapters 541 to 600 of the Transportation Code is going to get this $30 court cost. Now the Transportation Code tells us that if we remit it timely, we get to keep 5%. So $28.50 goes to the state, and $1.50 gets to stay with your city, and that has to be deposited in your city's general revenue fund. I don't have this one on here, but we also have the local traffic fee, which is $3, and that all gets to stay with your city. That also gets assessed on all rules of the road offenses. So kind of ironic that the city gets 10% of what the state's share is. So, city traffic fee is $3, whereas the state's is $30. Now, the moving violation, this is still a relatively new court cost. It went into effect back in 2009. This came about because of the new racial profiling laws. You know, racial profiling it's not legal in Texas. It's prohibited in Texas. Legislature prohibited back in 2003. And this last session, or 2009, the legislature said that police departments have to start reporting better instances of racial profiling. And TCLOS is supposed to keep a track of all the complaints against officers who have been reported for racial profiling. And if any officer ever changes agencies, they're supposed to go through and do a report on this. Well, at the last session, TCLOS said, wait a minute, this is an unfunded mandate. We don't have any money to do this. We're already stretched too thin. And so the legislature said, okay, well, let's add a new court cost. So they added this 10-cent moving violation fee. And it's going to apply on all moving violations, which DPS gets to classify, and they do so in the Texas Administrative Code. They call it the Civil Justice Data Repository Fund, and 9 cents has to go to the comptroller, and a penny gets to stay with your city, because that's the city's 10% for getting to remit this cost timely. This is also going to be deposited in your city's general revenue fund. All right, the child safety seat fee, another one from last session that we got to talk about. I don't know, which one gave y'all the bigger headache, this 15 cent or the 10 cent? The 10? Probably because it took DPS a year to come out with the list of what was a moving violation. But I think we've kind of finally started getting the hang of collecting the 10 cent. You know, 10 cents easy. It goes on the quarterly report. It fits in line with most of our other court costs. It just applies specifically to moving violations. This 15 cent is kind of an anomaly. It only applies to convictions, not deferreds, not the specialized DSC. It's only going to apply to people who are convicted of the child passenger safety seat offense. And how many of you really have convictions for the child passenger safety seat offense? Very few. So I heard some courts at the beginning when this one passed, they just wanted to take a dime and a nickel and tape them on a piece of paper and send them to the comptroller. But the stamp costs twice as much as what you're sending in the first place, or four times as much. This one has to be remitted monthly, not quarterly. It's not on the quarterly report. So we have a separate reporting form that's included in your materials. However, there's no penalty for reporting it late or remitting it late, and there's no reward if you remit it on time. Your city doesn't get to keep anything. So a lot of cities now have just started lumping it in with your electronic payment at the end of your quarterly report, and you just fill out the other form and send it in too. And this was kind of a goofy fund because, you know, we thought, okay, all this money that we collect on this 15 cents is going to be used to buy child passenger safety seats for poor families. And really, what legislator is going to vote against that? I mean, can you imagine their next campaign? You voted against poor kids and the safety of poor kids. No one's going to vote against it. But they didn't think about the fact that it was going to cost the state $5 million to start collecting this fund. And I think the most recent estimate I heard is we've collected $30,000 on these child passenger safety seat court costs. There was a bill this session that would repeal that 15 cent, but of course the fiscal note on that to spend another $5 million to go back to the way it was pre-2009, that bill got voted down. So we're still going to be collecting this 15 cents. Okay, let's skip down to the arrest fee. And I pointed out this one because it was in our hypothetical or our sample citation that we looked at. This is the $5 fee that's going to apply anytime an officer makes a warrantless arrest or writes a citation or a written notice to appear. The statute tells us that if the officer is employed by the state, so most times we're talking DPS troopers, and how many of your courts do you have citations filed by DPS troopers? Couple? Do they mostly go to JPs then, if they're in your area? Okay, so, but if you do ever have occasion where a state officer writes a citation in your city or makes a warrantless arrest, then the city has to send 20% of that arrest fee on to the state, which if it's a $5 fee, you're going to end up sending a dollar. The other $4 your city gets to keep, it gets deposited in the general revenue fund. The dollar that goes to the state also gets deposited in the state's general revenue fund. The warrant fee is kind of the same thing. This is the other big fee that we have. And believe it or not, there was a bill this session that would have upped the warrant fee to $75. I mean, these people have already not shown up once. Do we think they're going to pay an extra $25 if we up the cost? So that one didn't go anywhere either. But we do have a $50 warrant fee. And this is going to apply any time a warrant, a capias, or a capias profine is processed or executed by a peace officer. So we have to have a peace officer's hands on it. They have to be involved in it somehow. And we know what executing means. Person gets arrested and taken to jail or brought before you judges. Processing, we don't have a definition for. That's up to you judges when assessing court costs on whether or not a warrant or capias profine has actually been processed, whether or not you're going to assess that $50 fee. Again, if the arrest is made by a state officer, so we have DPS trooper who executes your city arrest warrant because he stops somebody on the highway for something unrelated, runs his license, and sees that there's a warrant out for his arrest, then the city has to send 20% or $10 to the state, and that would be remitted again on the quarterly report. There's a place to put this. The other 40 that your city would get to keep, or if it's not a state officer, all 50 goes into your city's general revenue fund. I've heard some cities have contracts with their warrant officers where it's kind of like a shoe salesman commission, where, you know, the warrant officer expects to get this $50 for every arrest that they make. The law doesn't say that. The law says that the money goes to the city. Whatever the city decides to do with it is up to the city, but we know that it's not like it's not a commission type thing like some officers have claimed. But that does go into the city's general revenue fund. And then I have the time payment fee on here because this is another biggie. I mean, we're looking at big court costs that really hit our wallets, and we're talking about big amounts. $25 is a pretty big one. The time payment fee applies to any time somebody pays off any part of a judgment on or after the 31st day from the date that judgment was entered. So if any part of the fine, any part of the court cost is paid after on or after 31 days, then the court would assess this time payment fee. If you have people on payment plans, we'd assess the time payment fee. Half of the money has to go to the state. I guess the state's mad that they're not getting their share of the court costs right away. So half of the money goes to the state. The other half gets to stay with your city. But the statute says that $2.50 of that money that stays with your city has to be used for the purpose of improving the efficiency of the administration of justice. And the city shall prioritize the needs of the judicial officer who collected that fee. So in your courts, who collects that fee? You all, right? The court clerk or the judge, if you're acting as court clerk or you're there to collect it. So the time payment fee is another one that we don't often really talk about, and a lot of people aren't aware that this is also a good fund to tap into for training. Now, this money is going to go into your city's general revenue fund, but the law tells us that $2.50 of every time payment fee is supposed to go back and benefit the court. So it's not going to have its own dedicated account, but if you can keep track of how many time payment fees have been assessed, this is a good fund to go to council and say, we need this for the court, and we want to use the time payment fee to do it. And you have the little statute in your notes to be able to show. Now, finally, when we're talking about court costs, I've put these other two up here. Judge Lander from the city of Dallas co-teaches this class with me at some of the other conferences, and he was always getting asked a lot of questions about the omnibase fee or collection agency fees. So if you have any questions about them, feel free to address them right now. We can talk about them. I mean, like I said, this isn't a class just on court costs, but this is another fee that will actually be something that is brought into the court that's not going to stay with your court. And it can be a biggie. $30 for every case that's turned over to omnibase. Your court's going to collect that $30, but you're only going to keep four of it. 26 of it's going 20 to the state and 6 to omnibase. So that makes a pretty big dent in your ledgers. Collection agency fees, you're going to be collecting that 30%, but then you're going to have to send it straight on to the collection agency. So these are both fees that, of the $30 omnibase fee, your city's only allowed to keep $4. And of that collection agency fee, your city can't keep any of it. So when you're looking at the amount of money that's brought into the court and what gets sent out, these are also money, or, you know, big funds that are not going to stay with your court. Any questions on the court costs? I mean, we know the state's going to want their share. Generally, it's 10%, sometimes 20% if we're talking a certain cost. We have these other ones that are going to go on to other people. But generally, court costs are what you're going to see collecting and then sending on to somebody else. Yes?
Will we go over any clarity on overpayments?
Overpayments. Yeah, I'll address that in a little bit. Okay. So now fines. Like I said, the general belief is court costs is what go to the state and fines stay with your city. But we do see there are other times where fine money either has to be used for a specific purpose, which means we can't really rely on it for general revenue, or some of it does have to get sent on to the state. Now, we know under the Transportation Code, money that is collected for offenses under Title VII of the Transportation Code, which is not only our rules of the road offenses, but also all of our registration offenses, driver's license offenses. If you have that handy little green book, you can see where Title VII starts. I think it's like Chapter 501. Starts Title VII, and it goes all the way to the end of the Transportation Code. So any fine money collected for any offense in Chapter 501 to 750 is supposed to be used to build roads in your city or to help with the enforcement of traffic laws in your city. And there's a statute in the Transportation Code that's cited in your handouts that actually tells you what the money is supposed to be used for. But we also have something that's called the 30% rule. So raise your hand high if your city has a population of less than 5,000 people. Most of the room. This 30% rule only applies to cities that have a population under 5,000 people. This is something that was kind of the state's attempt at curbing this whole cash cow idea. That, you know, we were hearing stories of cities that had one stop sign and, you know, 200 people that lived there, and they were collecting $9 million a year in traffic revenue. And the state said, wait a minute, we want our share of that $9 million. So they put in place this 30% rule. And basically, at its simplest terms, the 30% rule says that your city is only allowed to keep from traffic fines or special expense fees assessed on traffic violations up to 30% of your city's annual budget. Taking all sources of income for your city other than federal bonds or federal funding, your city can only keep 30% of whatever money is brought in traffic fines or revenue. Anything over 30% has to be sent to the state. So the way the statute is worded, it's kind of funny. It says anything over a dollar has to be sent onto the state. So once you reach that 30% and you have collected, so let's say that your annual city budget is $100,000, and your city finance director would know that from the year before, but let's say it's $100,000. Once your court has collected $30,000 from traffic fines or special expense fees, anything over a dollar that you collect after that point in that fiscal year has to be sent on to the state. So that can be a huge amount of money. If you have a very active traffic enforcement program, that can be a big amount. Now, the reason that this 30% rule is so important, if your city ever gets audited by the comptroller, trust me, they're going to want that money. They're going to want anything over that 30%. So just an example here. There's a city that's in Central Texas, southeast of San Marcos. They were audited because the Office of the Comptroller received several complaints about their ticketing practices, that they were just a speed trap. And so people were calling and complaining to the state all the time, and so they sent auditors down there and looked at the books for the court. And they found that the court or the city owed the comptroller $573,000 in excess traffic fine revenue. Now, in this economy, I don't know what city has $573,000 to write a check to the state, but they were audited twice, actually, you know, once when the complaints were coming in and they owed the money, and then again 4 years later to make sure that they had changed their practices. So anybody been through an audit from the comptroller's office in here? I hear it's kind of like going to the doctor for an exam. And so, I mean, not something that I think anybody's really looking forward to having happen. Now, if you think that's bad, we have another city that is southwest of Houston. And this city had to file for federal bankruptcy protection because the comptroller told them they owed $1.7 million in excess traffic fines and revenue. So if your city falls under this 5,000 population range, this is definitely something to make sure that you're following. Now, for all cities, regardless of size, we do have some individual offenses that require that some of the money go on to the state. The big ones that we see in our court are the child restraint offenses. So we had the hypo where, you know, a $25 fine on child passenger safety seats and $12.50 has to go to the state. We also have this if you have the unrestrained child not wearing a seatbelt, where the fine range for that could be $100 to $200. So $50 to $100 is going to have to go to the state for those fines. This gets remitted at the end of the year, at the end of your city's fiscal year, on a separate form, which is also in your handout. And it only applies to those two offenses for child restraint offenses. How many of your courts see school attendance cases? Quite a few. Those of you that see these school attendance cases filed by the school districts, are they often failure to attend school against the child, or are they parent contributing non-attendance against the parent? Both? Okay. This is something that kind of got overlooked in the first draft of this presentation and something that I had to go back and check in the green book that we actually had in there. But for parent contributing to non-attendance cases, 50% of the fine that's collected is supposed to go back to the school. But for failure to attend school cases, that doesn't apply. So, you know, if you have a charge against a child for failure to attend school and a fine is assessed, which we know, I mean, most times we're not going to assess a fine. They're a kid. They're not going to be able to pay it, so we let them do community service or something else. But if we have a case against the parent and a fine is assessed and it's a Class C misdemeanor with a fine of up to $500, then half of that fine money is supposed to be remitted back to the school. And that's in the actual parent contributing non-attendance statute, but it doesn't say how it gets remitted and it doesn't say when it gets remitted. So maybe the school district sends you a bill. Maybe, you know, the court just notifies the school district, hey, we have this much in fine money, how do you want it? There's no penalty for not sending it on to the school district, but I've often wondered, with the school's funding crisis right now that the state's seeing, are we not going to see more of these cases filed against the parent because the school district knows that they can get a little bit of money out of these cases and less filed against the student? So, I don't know, that's just a proposition. Yes? Yeah, because we can't file against those students.
Well, I mean, that's the parents that are not wanting to get up against mm-hmm. the school. Kids after that age, mm-hmm. grade, a lot of them wake themselves up.
Right.
So that's where I see most of my time.
Right. Those younger kids who are relying on their parents to take them in. Okay, we have a class going on, I think right now, actually, on the commercial vehicle enforcement. Any of your cities do the commercial vehicle enforcement? At 2 o'clock? Anybody going to that one? The legislature just passed a law that says that cities of a population of under 8,500 and that have any part of an interstate highway or federal highway going through their town are now eligible to do this commercial vehicle enforcement, whereas before you weren't. So we're going to see more and more smaller towns doing this commercial vehicle enforcement. 50% of the fine has to be sent to the state. This gets reported on your quarterly report. If you don't do it, you don't have to worry about this blank ever. They do throw in a little caveat that if you're within 20 miles of the Mexico border, you don't have to send that money to the state, but instead it has to be used to fix your roadways. So it's, again, more funding that might come into the city that has to be used for a dedicated purpose. And then I put this last one on here, Parks and Wildlife Code violations. I know if you are judges, you have the case law update in your handouts from that Ryan taught. This was an AG opinion that came out and brought to light a couple issues. Anybody see Parks and Wildlife Code violations in your court? Nobody? Some? Okay. There's been a lot of contention over whether or not municipal court has jurisdiction over these offenses, period. If you look in the Parks and Wildlife Code, they never mention municipal courts, but it's a fine-only misdemeanor. A Class C Parks and Wildlife Code violation is a fine-only misdemeanor, and we have concurrent jurisdiction over fine-only misdemeanors that happen within our city limits. There's an exception for Water Safety Act. We're not going to get into that. But the law says that the fine must be remitted to the Parks and Wildlife Department. And then it says in a justice court, 85% of the fine has to go. And in a county court or higher, 80% has to go. And they don't say what has to happen to a municipal court. So we've talked to the council over at the Parks and Wildlife Department, and they say, we don't have a problem if municipal courts are hearing our cases, but we still want our share of the fine. I said, well, what is your share of the fine? They said, 85, same as justice courts. And I said, okay, how do we remit it? Statute says it has to be remitted within 10 days, and it has to go with a little form. I said, where's the form? Well, we don't have one. They just write something up. And I said, well, where do they send it to? Well, usually the game warden just comes and picks it up. And I said, well, do you have a listing of the game warden so I can tell our judges who their game warden is to call? Well, we don't really have a very current one. I said, well, I don't think you're going to get any money from the municipal courts if you don't make it very easy for us. So, you know, if you do have a Parks and Wildlife Code violation that comes through your court, maybe call the JP and see how they usually handle it. I mean, I'm not saying that you don't have jurisdiction over it and you can't handle it in your court. I think that, you know, with the concurrent jurisdiction that we're given, I think we can. But I think that the time we're going to get in trouble with the Parks and Wildlife Department is when they don't see their portion of it. All right, so any questions on fines? There's a few other in the water code that I have listed on there that we're not going to mess with. But more often than not, the problem that comes up on these reporting is when we get partial payments. And we're going to fly through the rest of this, but the big point here is if we have partial payments, we only have to send the percentage. This is where it gets into the headache, and this is where we see that video clip at the beginning where sometimes you just want to quit because you have to keep track of all this stuff. But the big point is that we don't have to send anything we don't collect. So what do we collect in the first place? And there are two different times. Sometimes we might collect more than ordinarily we would. Sometimes we might collect less. If we collect more, it might be because we have an enhancement in place. And the big thing on enhancements is it's really the peace officer or the prosecutor's job to enhance a charge, not the judge's. I've put in the chart the times where something might be enhanced to have a higher fine, even though it's not going to be elevated to a Class B or a higher offense. But just if some circumstances are present, we might have a higher fine to apply. It might be that it's a second or subsequent offense, as we see in the handicap parking. You know, fifth offense, we're looking at a huge fine there. It might be that, you know, we have something like a construction zone or something where we know that the fine, the minimum and maximum are going to double. But a quick note on enhancements. City of Corpus Christi judges got raked over the coals in the media because the city was looking at the problem of uninsured drivers. And they went to the court, and they pulled all of the cases convicting people for FMFR, which are open records. And then they went and pulled all of the arrest reports from, or tickets from the police department for people who had been ticketed for FMFR. And they started matching up the names and realizing that this person, you know, Joe Blow, had 6 tickets for FMFR, yet every time, every judgment was alleging first offense and charging a $175 fine. And they were saying, wait a minute, these judges should be doing a $350 fine at least. They could be collecting up to $1,000. Why are we not getting this money? Why is the city not collecting this money? And the judges, I mean, they tried to turn them over to the commission. They were telling them in the media that the city council needed to appoint new judges that would bring in more money. And the point was, the judge can't assess a higher fine if you don't know that it's a higher offense. So the judges were doing what we believe was right. And when they called, we said, it's not your job to enhance. But this was another time where the judge faced some criticism because somebody else figured out you weren't assessing a higher fine when you could have been. Now, on the flip side, we might not collect money at all. This is going to be another time where you might face some criticism if you're not collecting, you know, enough. It might be that you allow somebody to work to pay off a fine and cost doing community service, which the judge has the discretion to do if we find that they're indigent. If they don't pay, we can always make that determination and allow them to do that as a second chance. It might be that we give somebody jail credit. They might be entitled to it because it's on that case. It might be that they're serving time in the pen for some unrelated charge, and we just want to get it off the book, so you grant them jail credit for time served. It might be that the judge makes a waiver of fines altogether, and you're allowed to do that in the instance that you find the defendant is indigent, and you find that them discharging their fine and costs through community service would be an undue hardship. Single mother, 8 kids, trying to do a job, still falls under the poverty guidelines, how is she going to have time to do community service? The judge also can waive court costs in that same instance. And judges can waive court costs altogether if somebody goes through teen court. So you can, you know, that would be another time where the state's not going to get the money. And again, if we waive costs or you waive fines, we don't have to send anything to the state because we're not collecting any money. We only have to send on the money that we actually collect. So if somebody does community service, time served, waiver of fines or costs, we don't send anything to state. Now, if we have overpayment, I think it's kind of an unrelated question, but overpayment, if somebody pays too much money, that's money that the court's not entitled to keep. Whatever the amount of the money and the costs that go in the judgment, that's what the court's entitled to collect. Anything above that would need to be returned to the person, I think. Because the people are paying too much money?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something, she said that the city's making them send it all back. I think that's something to discuss with your city finance director. I think that they're trying to cover their own butt, but it does get complicated there. Okay, so we've talked about this concept of the municipal court being a cash cow for the city government and looking at, you know, what money it is that we're bringing in or why we're not bringing in as much money as somebody might expect. So, you know, we've talked about ways to explain. Well, we're not bringing in more money because we have the discretion as judges to waive the fines and court costs if we find these people are indigent. Or we're doing community service because these people don't have the money to pay. It might be I'm only assessing a $175 fine because I only know that this is a first offense. I haven't been told that it's a second offense. It might be we're bringing in more money that you're thinking because these offenses are happening in construction zones. Or they're not saying workers are present, so I can't double the fine. So different times that we would have these claims to say why something is coming in or not. Now, the National Center for State Courts has looked at this issue. They've answered questions on how the court should deal with authorities who see it as a cash cow to generate local revenue. And they say that the independence of the judiciary requires that courts be free of political influences, not be subject in their operation to revenue production requirements, and provide impartial judges and hearing officers. You know, basically, we shouldn't be, you know, just trying to bring in money for the cities. Now, we know Texas law says that a city cannot impose a quota. They can't do it on peace officers. Quotas have been outlawed on peace officers. But we also have quotas against cities reprimanding judges or evaluating judges based on the money that you're bringing in. So last session, they finally closed a loophole that we had where they weren't supposed to suggest you to bring in any amount of money, but they could not reappoint you if you didn't bring in enough. Well, that loophole's been removed. So now we know that the city is not supposed to require or suggest that a judge collect any predetermined amount of money. And we also have the canon of judicial conduct that tells us the judge should be faithful to the law and not be swayed by partisan interests, public clamor, or fear of criticism. So judges are not supposed to act as a rubber stamp for the city. We're not supposed to be concerned with the money that comes in. However, city officials are going to be concerned with it. And so we kind of have to do a little balancing act at the end. And remember that municipal court revenues are important to our city budgets. This is how, I mean, your city, if you have an operating municipal court, they're relying on the money that this court is bringing in, not only to keep the court going, but also to help fund things for the city. So we do have to worry about municipal court revenues. And city officials, it's their job to be concerned with budgets. I mean, if they weren't concerned with budgets, what would happen to all of our cities? So we know that they're the banker hat. They're thinking we have to be able to fund the city. We have to be able to bring in this income. This is our job to be concerned with it. However, municipal court should be free from a lot of this influence. You know, we have to follow the rules of judicial conduct. We have to think about separation of powers and what our goal is. And our goal here is not just to collect money, but to seek justice. But we are part of the city. We're state courts, but we are part of the city. And we have to be careful that if we refuse to share budgetary information or cooperate with the city, it could be a violation of the canon. So I've heard from some judges who every month they go before council and present a report on the money that the court's bringing in and the status of the court. And they've developed a good rapport with the city council, and there is no arguing. I've also heard horror stories, and the call that actually got this ball rolling was one day I got a message from a court clerk. It had the phone number to call her back. We were doing a webinar or something. I couldn't take the call live. So the webinar finishes, I go to lunch, I come back, I'm about to return the legal calls from my shift, and Crystal, our receptionist, calls and says, the judge from that call, the city earlier, is on the phone. Can you talk to him? And I said, sure. You know, I haven't called the clerk back yet, but I'll talk to the judge. So I pick up the phone, and he just starts yelling. I said, well, good afternoon, judge. I was just about to call your court clerk back. And he says, well, I haven't heard back from you yet, and I have a question. I said, okay, what's the problem? He says, I want to know about court costs. I said, what about him? He said, I want to know why we're sending so much money to the state. And I said, well, you know, I don't have a good reason for why, other than the law tells us that we have to. And he says, well, my clerk made a presentation to council last week, and she showed how much money is going to the state, and I think she's doing it all wrong. And I said, well, you know, I mean, if you have specific questions, I can send you charts. I can show you what portion goes, you know, trying to talk to him. And he finally says, well, I'm the mayor of this town. And I said, ooh, I'm not supposed to be talking to you. I thought you were the judge. And he's like, no. So I tell him, you know, well, if you have questions about court costs, call the comptroller. He wanted to think the clerk was doing something wrong for sending the money in on the quarterly report. So I call the number back on the message pad, and it's the mayor's cell phone. So I look up the clerk's number, and I said, why did you give me the mayor's cell phone? She said, well, he's my boss, and he was mad at me, and I had to leave a message, and he wanted to call back. And so here this poor court clerk is being, you know, she's getting in trouble by the mayor for sending on the money that the state requires get sent on. So, you know, just something to, hopefully there's now some resources that you have to show what money should be going to the state, why money is going to the state, what money is staying with the city, and what that can be used for. But we are seeing more of an awareness around this, and I'll just tell you as we close that the TML has their magazine, the Texas Town and City Magazine, and they're starting to point out the fact that many people mistakenly believe that cities are deriving their income from traffic tickets, when in reality the majority of the money that cities are bringing from traffic tickets is really funding the state, not being a cash cow for the city. So any questions, I'll be out in the hall, but thanks for coming. Enjoy the rest of the conference.